just a second ago.
Yep.
Thank you. Senator Pappas moves the amendment, or the, I'm sorry, the minutes from Wednesday, January 24th, 2007. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Minutes are approved.
He was here.
It's here like 2 seconds ago.
He was in the room here just a minute ago.
Maybe he went to the restroom.
Where's Myron?
Neither a quorum nor an author were in trouble.
And Myron Orfield was here, too. I saw him. Myron Orfield was here.
Mm-hmm. Here comes Senator Wieger.
There he is.
Okay. Hello, Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and will this be for the Metro Council?
Yes, Senate File 81. Senator Rest.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, yes. And that will be just a moment. Mr. Chair and subcommittee members, Senate File 81 is very direct. It calls for an elected Metropolitan Council. As you know, the council recently celebrated its 40th anniversary, and I have many good things to say about the accomplishments of the council, particularly in parks and open space, addressing waste control in the region, to varying degrees, transit issues, cleaner water. Other issues need to be addressed as well. But the fundamental issue that is before us, again, is whether it should be elected or not. 10 years ago, the legislature voted for an elected Metropolitan Council. Then Representative Orfield, then to join the Senate, and sponsored that. And it was vetoed by the governor. It had passed or nearly passed in earlier debates by the legislature. So that is the primary focus as to the election, not to debate whether the current council or previous councils, and I'll point out I did serve as a council member, it's whether it should be an elected body. And I would go to the taxation without representation argument. The principle is important, and to put all of the jurisdiction for that body by an appointment of the governor is not in the best interests of the region or of the state. The bill has an author's an A2 amendment, and Mr. Chair, if someone could move the A2 to put it in the form.
Senator Pappas moves the A2 amendment.
And the amendment basically puts out it deletes a reference that said initially in the bill that county commissioners could serve on the council and as a county commissioner. Thinking further about that you shouldn't serve two masters, that is one of the deletions. And then the other is a technical deletion at the advice of council regarding the listing of previous Metro Council districts.
Thank you, Senator Wieger, to get the bill in the shape. Senator Rest.
Did you say there was a technical amendment or a delete all amendment?
It's
technical in the A2.
I believe we have the technical. It's not a delete all.
I believe it's
the just a technical?
Yes.
A2 amendment. That's great. Does everyone have the A2 amendment?
Yeah.
Any further discussion about the A2 amendment? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, there are several sections, but I'll highlight the overview on the bill, and the thrust is for an elected council, and it would have members eligible for public financing, just as we are, and puts
puts this through the Campaign Finance Board. And as you can see in Section 1, it defines candidate through Chapter 10A. For Section 2, it also references the Campaign Finance Board and requirements that are there, for example, for economic interest statements. There's a spending limit, $47,000, for persons that would impose that if they accepted funds through the Campaign Finance Board. And Section 4 says you could accept $500 in an election year, $100 in non-election years. And as I am pointing these items out, this is basically what was passed 10 years ago for the institutional memory here. The public subsidy is further discussed in Sections 5 and 6. As a candidate, to get that public subsidy, just as we need to raise a threshold amount in Section 7, it would be $2,500. You would return excess public subsidy money under Section 8. Various requirements that we have as candidates now that you would have through the Campaign Finance Board in subsequent sections. The Secretary of State in Section 15 would allocate the election expenses to the council just as they currently do for counties, cities, and school districts. The council members would be elected at the state general election held in a year before their terms expire. Section 18 addresses special elections and various details to the extent that we will pursue those further in discussion we can talk about. But one item in Section 26 is the selection of the chair, and that is by the members themselves. They would elect the chair. Salary is at Section 27, and it says not more than $12,000 a year. And members, I believe now they get $20,000. I would be open for a friendly amendment if it was changed to that amount, if that's where we're going. And we have some further direction relating to the council's performance and budget, and that's referred to in Section 28. The council would draw its lines and under Section 29, and that would be done after each federal decennial census. The Section 30 calls for some additional studies to be done by the council that looks at functions, services that are currently being done by the counties to look at the feasibility of whether there should be a transfer of some of those duties and functions, and that would be reported to the legislature at the end of the year. And the salary of the chair, that is repealed, and the repealers in Section 32, as well as other provisions that need to be repealed so that we're consistent with the intent in the new provisions. And again, this is fairly close, if not identical, except for updates on the dates to what was passed by the House and the Senate in a bipartisan fashion 10 years ago. So that is an overview, and I'd like to call on former state senator and state representative, now U of M law professor, Myron Orfield, who has a PowerPoint and a great deal of background on this issue, and Jim Hetland. I'm not sure if Jim's arrived yet, but he was the first chair of the Metropolitan Council, and he will be here as well to testify in behalf of the bill.
Thank you, Senator Wieger, former Senator Orfield.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to come here today. My name is Myron Orfield. I was a senator here for one term and a House member for five terms in the legislature. I am a law professor at the University of Minnesota. I teach local government law and issues that relate to land use and planning. I am coming here today to testify on behalf of an elected Metropolitan Council. When I was in the legislature, I worked for many years on these issues. I authored these bills with then-Representative Pawlenty, who is now the governor. He was a co-author of these bills for the time that I did this. I think we authored them together for five terms. I don't think this is a partisan issue particularly. I know Chair Hetland is coming today. He was a Republican appointee of Governor Lavander, and I know that he believes in this as well. The elected Metropolitan Council was an issue that was hotly debated for many years in the legislature. It failed by a single vote when the Met Council was created in 1967. Then Governor Lavander would have supported it. It failed by a single vote in the Senate. It passed 10 years ago, in a bipartisan way, with the then governor, an author of the bill, and supporting the bill. I think one of the things about the Met Council, why many people believe that it ought to be elected, is that it is a very important institution. It is one of the largest local units of government in the state. I have a PowerPoint, which I will distribute today, just to give you a sense of its budget and its scale and its scope. In the United States, particularly, since the founding of the Republic, bodies that have had significant taxing and spending authority that are multi-purpose in character have been elected. It's not an exaggeration to say that one of the founding reasons of the United States was the principle of no taxation without representation. It seemed to be a minor point with the English Parliament, but it was a major point with the colonists that taxes shouldn't be levied on them without their members being elected to Parliament. And if you read the Declaration of Independence, the grievances that are reproduced in the Declaration relate largely to that point, or at least in very large part to that point of it's not the amount of taxation, it's the principle. It is the notion that elected bodies, that local government, that the right to petition and be part of it is a fundamental part of our democracy. Now, there are many agencies, state agencies, that are large in scale, that are unelected. They tend not to have a multifaceted jurisdiction. They tend to be doing one single purpose. Local governments, though, that have a multi-purpose function, that have large budgets and large taxing authorities, there's no real precedent for having bodies that are this large that perform these kinds of discretionary tasks at being unelected. Now, if I were to show you the slides that I'm going to show you, and I'm happy to provide these to the committee, the Met Council is one of the largest units of local government in the state of Minnesota. It is second only to Hennepin County in its total budgetary expenditures. So Hennepin County is slightly larger, but the Metropolitan Council is next. Minneapolis, City of Minneapolis, is close by. Maybe you're going to get this picture. Let's see.
Last time we tried to watch a PowerPoint, it didn't work. Oh,
yeah.
This room.
Okay. Well, I were to show you a chart, it would show the total expenditures of the Metropolitan Council, and it would have the Hennepin County very high, and the Met Council in Minneapolis, the city of Minneapolis, being close. Well, this might be.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pappas.
Just a little bit. Senator Orfield, where does the Ramsey County fit in?
Ramsey County is, it looks like not. It's about two-thirds. The Ramsey County budget, a little over $500 million. The Met Council, something over $600 million. So, and here we go.
It's below Minneapolis, but above St. Paul?
It's above Ramsey County, and it's above St. Paul, too, yes. Okay. I'll provide this to the committee. You can take a look at it. And I'm going to focus most of my testimony just on the scale and scope of the Metropolitan Council and kind of how the principles of democratic representation and taxation relate to it. It's the size of the Met Council. The council's seven-county jurisdiction contains about more than one-half of the state's population. The seven-county area is rapidly urbanizing. And I had a map that showed this was from the remote sensing and geospatial analysis laboratory at the University of Minnesota. I just clipped these slides. You can see the council, the metropolitan area urbanizing. This is the urbanized population in 86, 91, 98, 2002. The Metropolitan Council tries to coordinate the land use planning powers of 189 separate local units of government with land use planning powers, which is a huge number of local governments. It's a very difficult and complex function. The Met Council spends more per year than every other general purpose government in the metropolitan area except Hennepin County and Minneapolis. They have larger budgets, but the Met Council's direct expenditures are third. This is the total expenditures. You can see Hennepin County in the range between $1.5 billion and $2 billion. You see the council in the $600 million range. You see the city of Minneapolis a little bit above the council. But you look at the other counties, Ramsey, Dakota, Anoka, Washington, Scott, Carver, are tiny fractions of the budget of the Met Council. The Met Council has more bonded debt than every other general-purpose government in the metro except Minneapolis. So it issues more bonds than every other general-purpose government, a government that's more than a single purpose, that has a multi-purpose function, than any government except Minneapolis. It has more bonded debt than county governments in its seven component counties combined. So there's more bonded debt than the seven counties are combined in terms of its bonded debt. And you can see the bonded debt. Here's Hennepin County, Ramsey County. And you see the city of St. Paul. You see the city of Minneapolis and the Metropolitan Council. So it not only supervises a fairly big direct budget, but has very significant bonded debt. The Met Council's bonded debt is increasing steadily from about $500 million a year in 1991 to a little bit more than $1 billion in 2005. So the bonded debt is increasing. This is a trend map that shows the bonded debt of the council, and it's increased over the years, and again, more than the seven counties combined. The Met Council's revenues come 33% from charges, 30% from federal aid, 17% from state aid, and 16% from property taxes. And whether a fee is a tax, I think this is a question that the legislature is probably more apt to answer than a local government law professor. These are big questions, but they're local revenues, and they're levied or assessed or charged to the residents of the metropolitan area. And again, I think local governments, particularly general-purpose governments that have multi-purpose functions, that have this kind of taxing and spending authority, as a general rule, they are elected. I don't know of any precedent for anything that is this large and has this kind of budgetary authority and this kind of spending and this kind of taxing power that isn't directly elected. This is the council's revenues. You can see from charges, from federal aid, from state aid. Property taxes are $114 million a year at 16% of the council's revenues. The Met Council collects more property taxes than every other general-purpose government in the metropolitan area except Hennepin County and Ramsey County in Minneapolis. So its property tax levy is bigger than any of the local governments except those. This is the total property taxes. You can see Hennepin with the largest amount of collections, Ramsey, Dakota, and you can see the city of Minneapolis and the Metropolitan Council. They're large, very large, powerful local units of government. The scope of the Met Council, the council is committed to providing sewer and water treatment and transportation to 31% of the geographic area of the Metropolitan Council in the seven counties. This is expected to increase to 40% by 2030. This is a map showing the expanding scope of the MUSA line, the area that the region is committed to providing sewer and resource infrastructure. And this is expanding. This is where a lot of the debt is coming in, the bonded debt that's increasing rapidly to support this. The Met Council, this is the sewer infrastructure that the Met Council maintains, which is kind of the infrastructure of growth in the metropolitan area and where a lot of the bonded debt comes in. This is the year built. You can see the progress of this. This is my testimony, largely, is that it is a very powerful and significant unit of government. It is the largest local unit of government, probably except for Minneapolis and the Hennepin County. Arguably, it's got more bonded debt. It has coordinating power to try to lay out a metropolitan sewer plan, land use plan, run a metropolitan transportation system. It has many functions like a municipality in a general purpose government. Has a very big effect on the way that our region will be shaped and what kind of a region we're going to become, probably more powerful and important than any other local unit of government. And I believe, like then-Representative Pawlenty and Chair Hetland and many people over the years, that things that are this powerful and this big and tax this much in the United States need to be directly elected by the people so that individuals can participate in these kinds of decisions, so that people have a right to petition and redress their government about things that are this important. So I thank you for the opportunity to testify. It's a privilege to be back here. I appreciate this opportunity to petition my government for something I believe in.
Thank you, Mr. Arfield. Are there any questions? Senator Rest.
Through 2002, do you have anything that's more, or do you have the, even if you don't have the slide, more recent information about where the revenues come from for Met Council? And maybe we should already know that, but I'm just curious.
This is searching the internet. This is from the Met Council's.
Just through 2002.
Yeah, I don't have anything more current, but I'm sure you could have it at your fingertips.
Thank you.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Arfield, Senator Wieger. I'm concerned about a $12,000 salary. Mm-hmm. I think that and I'm also concerned that this is viewed as a part-time job when, you know, you've got an entity that's larger than Hennepin County. Hennepin County is full-time. I think Ramsey County is virtually full-time, as the city councils are full-time. I mean, you don't want people just doing this as a hobby. You want people to be there full-time. I mean, certainly the legislative salary is an ongoing problem, but at least we're half-year, whereas these entities meet year-round, I believe, right, Senator Wieger? My council meets year-round.
Senator Wieger, Senator Pappas, yes, it does.
So I think, you know, who are you going to find that's going to be willing to run? I imagine the district is larger than
basically
a Senate district.
This.
Maybe I think it's like double the Senate district. You've got spending limits, so you can't spend as much as even you can in a Senate district. And then your salary is $12,000?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, maybe I went over this point quickly, but I'm very amenable to changing that amount.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pappas.
I know. You said to $20,000, which I still think is paltry. Why can't they just set it themselves? If they're going to be elected officials, why can't, like any other elected official body, like the counties do and theoretically the legislature does, to just set it themselves?
Senator
Chair, Senator Pappas, that's a reasonable option. That is fine.
I mean,
that was an intent that was later expressed by some to getting it passed. But if I would trust the judgment of that council in deciding that, just as they would decide who would be the chair of that body. So if you wanted to make that as an amendment, they would decide.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, as I think about it, though, running for an office where you don't know what the salary is may not be such a great idea. I mean, we should probably decide on a starting salary. And I don't know if I can make that decision right this minute, but we should probably decide on that, but then give them the authority after that to raise their own salary.
It seems to me that thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Pappas, Senator Wieger asked me what I thought of this. It seems to me perfectly sensible. I think that these are political decisions, you know, about what people believe is due the representatives. I testify today in the belief that it's really important that it be directly elected because of the democratic concerns of taxation and representation. Salary, I think it is a significant job. It's a very significant job. It presently is a significant job. I think it's difficult to find people that will accept appointment to these significant responsibilities at this salary. So I think that these are real issues. I remember being in the legislature and the salary that was paid and the fact that it was an important thing. So I don't have any objection to it. I think that one of the issues about the salary is people have objected to raising the salary of any public officials.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I could ask Mr. Watson to draft some language that would set up a beginning salary of $40,000, and then for the first term, and then the council members would set their own salary after that. And maybe Senator Marty is smiling. Senator Marty, you think that's too much or too little?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, I think they may not want to raise their own salaries because of the politics of that, but I'm not arguing against your amendment. I'm just saying that knowing how the legislature doesn't like to deal with its own salary issues, I think they may prefer somebody else set them for them. But.
Well, Mr. Chairman, so I am setting it for them.
You
so
are.
If they wanted to go above that, you know. And, I mean, the county boards do raise their salaries. We don't like it when they do it because we never raise ours, but they do, and the city council mm-hmm. raises their salaries, so.
Senator Rest.
I'm looking at the Section 27, the actual language mm-hmm. of it, and I mean, it may not be a very good model, but if you set that, if you wanted to have an amendment that set it at $40,000 a year, and then also allowing for actual and necessary expenses to be reimbursed and allowing them to adopt a per diem in addition to that, that might, without stating what it would be, mm-hmm. that might take care of their political reluctance to raise a base salary that we see evidenced every single year since I can remember in the legislature. I don't know if you would want to include that as part of your amendment, some sort of allowance for per diem in addition to actual expenses being repaid that are, you know, that are reimbursed, that are vouchered.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pappas.
So, Senator Rist, are you suggesting that we keep the language of not to exceed $40,000 per year, but then allow for per diem?
Then what they would vote on would be a per diem allowance.
And Mr. Watson,
I don't know whether that's a.
I wonder if Mr.
That's
Chairman,
a good model. It's the model that the legislature.
But we get where it's a problem for us.
But the question, one of the questions that I have for council is, does the language that's currently in the bill allow for the creation of a per diem by the Met Council? And if we address the salary amount, are they able to create based on reimbursement for necessary and actual expenses? Do they have the ability to have a per diem?
Mr. Chairman, the language, as you've pointed out, requires reimbursement for actual and necessary expenses. It neither authorizes nor prohibits those expenses from being stated as a per diem amount. I think that if you want them to get a per diem, it probably would be well to specifically authorize that, because they're the main question with a per diem is the extent to which there needs to be vouchers to support the payment of that amount. And if the idea is that there will not be any requirement for vouchers, then you probably ought to say that.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pappas.
You know, I think my preference that I'd present to the committee is that, as I first stated, is we set a base salary and then we allow them after a period of time, I'm not sure what, after their first reelection or, you know, after they're served for a while or whatever, after they're serving, to then from then on set their own salary. And I think it's better not to go down the per diem route, but to do the actual expenses, because I think that's the whole issue. The public complains to us about raising our per diem and not raising our salaries. And we know that we haven't been able to raise our salaries. And that would be a better route to go. It would be more transparent than using per diems.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Rest.
So, in looking at the language on page 14, are you just suggesting that
14 instead of 12.
You delete 12,000 and insert 40? And then an additional sentence about their next term. It would seem to me that if you don't want people raising their own salary during their term of office, that you would say they're not eligible to receive any increase until they are not voting on their own salary increase. Do you understand what I mean?
I understand.
Except
what
these
you're
terms
saying.
Are staggered.
I don't think that's the way local government works, though. I think that's the way the legislature works. But I think it'd be better to use the model of local government, where when they raise their salaries, and they don't have to stand for election before it goes into effect. And if the voters don't like that they raise their salaries, they cannot vote for them at the next election. So that's the model I'm looking at. And I'm just trying to help them out so that when people are running for the office, they at least know. Mm-hmm. So they're not coming in into a blind, you know, not knowing what their colleagues are going to agree to in terms of a salary, so that we'd have a starting salary of $40,000. And I don't know how to say that, but that's my intent.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, I see that it says in the bill $12,000. I don't know what they're paid now. You're picking $40,000. I'm just curious. I thought, I know legislature is considered part-time and some work full-time, some don't. Met Council, I thought a whole lot of them work very part-time. I'm just curious. I'm not just knowing some of the ones who have represented areas near mine. I'm just curious how much time people are spending on Met Council and how you pick $40,000.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Marty, they're paid $20,000 now, so I think it's very clearly that it's a part-time job. But I think the amount of, you know, and I'm sure a lot of the work and responsibility then falls on the chair, who is paid a full-time salary, I believe, of, it says in here,
$58,000.
And I think this would... The expectation at $40,000 plus would be that this is a full-time job for the Met Council members.
Well, and I think that given the fact that the candidates would, or the council members would stand for election and go through that process, likely they would become far more active in terms of their engagement just because of the likely engagement from the public that they will get from their higher visibility and the fact that they're elected people. So I think in some ways it does change the nature of the council.
Right.
Senator Marty. Chairman, then maybe I have a question for Senator Wieger, where the $12,000 came from if they're already paid $20,000.
Senator Wieger.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, that was in the earlier 1997 version, so it hasn't been adjusted for inflation.
Senator Pep.
Go ahead.
Senator Pappas, it sounds like maybe you have a motion.
Well, Mr. Chairman, while I'm waiting for the language, I wanted to bring up another issue, and that is Section 30 of the bill on page 15. This looks like, okay, now we're asking the council to take on even, potentially, it's a study, to take on more functions, county correctional facilities, county highways. I don't know how the counties would feel about that, but... I think they already have their plate pretty full.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, they have this authority if they want to initiate this type of study. It was suggested in an earlier version. The key here is election, and if that was something you wanted to take out, I'm okay with that.
I think that, Mr. Chairman, Senator Wieger, I think that might hurt your bill, and I think counties already might be a little... I think elected officials in general are nervous about competing with another elected office. And if the counties feel that now some of their functions might end up, they might lose some of their functions, I think it could create unnecessary opposition. So I would just move to delete Section 30.
Senator Pappas moves to delete Section 30 of the bill. Is there further discussion about the amendment? Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, I'd argue against that. I actually... Like that, I think we ought to be discussing whether, I told Senator Wieger when he mentioned he had this bill that I like the idea of elected Met Council, but I'm wondering why we need to have that extra layer of government and why we couldn't merge the counties with it. And I realize it's a major step to do, but I think we ought to at least look at it if we're going to be making this another level of elected officials, because I've always kind of thought we ought to have a metro-wide county instead of a Met Council and seven counties. But
well, Mr. Chairman, I'll withdraw my motion. I think we'll just see how it... Oh, you want to vote on it?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
I think the argument that you made before, it's convincing to me. I think that I disagree with Senator Marty. I think the Met Council has gone through a number of reorganizational efforts and... et cetera, and I don't see that. If what we're trying to do is create an elected Met Council, and that's the thing that both Mr. Orfield and Senator Wieger are proposing, we're not talking about the Met Council in 1997. We're talking about the Met Council in 2007, and I would agree with you that that Section 30 is not necessary, and I will support the motion to delete it.
Okay, I'll renew my motion.
Senator Pappas renews her motion. Senator Marty.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I guess the question is, yes, I realize the bill is only dealing with the Met Council. Former Representative Bishop, who had his, I don't know what it was, 10 counties statewide proposal, I thought that was worth a serious look. Whether it was a great idea or not, I'm not sure, but I would like to see us go a little further than this report and not just look at economies of scale, but looking about whether we have as a governance system for the metro area one big county, metro council, whatever you call it, or whether we need, I mean, we have all kinds of jurisdictions. We got the counties, we got the state, the counties, the cities, the Met Council. It seems to me we have more than enough jurisdictions, governing agencies to deal with it, and I frankly think we ought to, if we're going to make this an elected position, which I think it should be, as Mr. Orfield spoke about the reasons for that, I think we should also be questioning why we shouldn't be doing it, taking a look at whether county government stuff could be equally well or better dealt with through this system. But.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, and that could be a separate bill. I could support that as a separate bill.
And Senator Pappas, Senator Marty, that's what I guess has occurred to me as part of this discussion is that is probably a worthy discussion we ought to have. However, it will, if both of these discussions occur in this bill, I do think that it probably will weight the bill down quite a bit. Senator Pappas has renewed her motion that we delete Section 30. Is there any further discussion? Senator Gimsey.
Mr. Chairman, it just seems to me that all this is a study and a report. It isn't actually putting this into action. It's just taking a look at it rather than implementing it. And I think it may be a good idea to have them take a look at this under the provisions of this. I would support that.
All right. Senator Gimsey, is there any further discussion? Senator Gerlach, would you like to weigh in on this?
Very progressive.
I think we're ready to vote. We've got folks that have strong feelings about this. On Senator Pappas's motion to delete Section 30 from the bill, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Pappas had raised the issues about salary. Mr. Watson, can you give us some direction?
Mr. Chairman, I would suggest on page 14, line 23, delete, but not to exceed $12,000 per year. And then on page 16, after line 2, insert a new section to read Section 31, initial salary. Notwithstanding Section 27, the salary of members elected to the Metropolitan Council at the general election in 2008 must not exceed $40,000.
Great.
Everybody have that. Senator Pappas moves.
Mr. Chairman, I just have a question for Mr. Watson.
Senator Pappas.
Why does it say must not exceed? Does that mean it could be, why, in what circumstances would it be less?
It would move to make it less.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pappas, if you wanted to just say it's 40,000, that's fine. The language in 27 says that they set their own salary. Okay. They have total discretion.
Okay, so even their initial salary, they could set for less then?
Yes.
Okay. That's fine.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I just wonder what the author thinks of this amendment.
Senator Wieger.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, as I said initially, my focus is making an elected body. the salary, I believe, should be set by the council, and just as other local governmental bodies do that. But for starting up, a figure is necessary, and I believe 40 is reasonable.
We have the amendment as relayed to us by Mr. Watson. Senator Pappas which is page 14, line 23, delete not to exceed $12,000 per year. And then on page 16, line 2, insert section 31, initial salary, notwithstanding section 27, the salary of members elected to the Metropolitan Council in the general election of 2008 must not exceed $40,000. Is there further discussion? All those in favor of Senator Pappas's motion, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted.
Too much.
Senator Wieger, is there...
Mr.
Let's
Chair,
see, we have another testifier.
Mr. Hetland is not going to be able to make it, but okay. There were some other organizations that wanted to testify, and you know, for the record, the Sierra Club supports the proposal with the suggestion that the salary will be higher, and I think you're a bit higher now than that figure, but the key was that they wanted to be an elected body. They also suggested that the chair be elected for a two-year term instead of one. But we do have a representative here from Isaiah. If Sarah Gleason could make a statement.
Ms. Gleason here. And then I've been informed by the request from the Metropolitan Council staff to address the committee as well. Ms. Gleason.
Mr. Chair, Senators, thank you. I'll be brief. I'm the chair of the legislative strategy table for Isaiah, which is an interdenominational coalition of congregations in the metro area and the central Minnesota area. And we work together toward a community based on hope, community, and shared abundance. More importantly, probably for this, I'm a member of our Metropolitan Equity Committee, which is a committee that works on issues related to regional equity, things like brownfields, affordable housing, transit. And so over the years, we've had a lot of interaction with the Metropolitan Council. And we're very proud of Minnesota having a Metropolitan Council, having the foresight to really think about long-term planning, this region as one community. This has been very important to us. We are definitely in favor of an elected Met Council. And this is based on the fact that we find them, we see our role really as to be co-creators with our elected officials of our shared future. And the Met Council makes many very important decisions that impact our future. And we've had varying experiences interacting with them, and including experiences where citizens have been unable over very long periods of time to have any contact with members who are theoretically representing them on the council. And we believe that an elected Met Council really is about democracy. This is about our shared future as much as the state legislature is. And it's important to us, as we see our role in this democracy, to be able to participate in electing our representatives to this council and to be able to have relationships with them that have some accountability. So we would be in favor of an elected Met Council. We are not weighing in on specifics, but really just on the principle of an elected Met Council.
Thank you, Ms. Gleason. Mr. Shetnan.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Before he comes up, Senator Wieger. Just understanding, trying to, currently the legislature has responsibility for redrawing the boundaries of the council districts, and in the bill, the Metropolitan Council itself as an elected body, is what I'm assuming then.
Yes.
Much like county boards and city councils would draw its own districts, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Shetland.
Thank you, Senator. And I want to point out that Senator Wieger has been a very close friend of the Met Council over the past many years, and also a former council member. So I am not up here in any way to say that we don't appreciate Senator Wieger's efforts for us in the past. However, I'd like to just point out a couple points regarding the elected Met Council. And the point that is brought up about taxation without representation, I'd like to address just briefly here. The council is appointed strictly by the governor. The governor has a nominating committee that is made up mostly of local elected officials throughout the metropolitan area. Those elected officials make recommendations to the governor. The governor then will heed their advice and make recommendations to the legislature. The legislature then gets to review these, and then we come before Senator Rest's full committee, where the chair of the Met Council is confirmed before he goes to the full Senate body, and similarly for the 16 remaining council members. So we'd like to point out that, one, there is accountability strictly to the governor when we as far as taxation and as far as the council appointments. One of the other points I'd like to make is the legislature sets our levies. Back in 2001, when we did the tax overhaul, what happened there was that tax or the transit piece of the property taxes was taken off of the property tax rolls. And that, like in today's numbers, out of MVEST, we're expecting to get about $250 million. That has been taken off of the property tax rolls. So currently we are levying close to maybe $50 million as opposed to $300 million back in 2001. So that has been significantly reduced. Of that, the legislature still sets the limit for what we can do for everything else, which is our regional administration levy, which is our livable communities levy, which is our levy for highway right-of-way loan funds. And those levies, they're not insignificant, but when you look at what the council had as far as taxation without representation at that point was much larger. Back in 2003, then, there was a Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Governance, which was put in place, which Senator Rest chaired. That bill, there's a bill currently moving to abolish that commission. The council is not opposing that either, but with that, we are also supporting Senator Rest and Representative Hornstein's position that the council be accountable to the legislature, which we, I believe, are very accountable to the legislature. We come here every year. We are scrutinized for almost everything that we do for good reason. I mean, we are a large operating agency. We operate over 600 miles of regional interceptors. Wastewater, yes, it is a gigantic piece of our budget. However, that system pays for itself through fees that we pass on to cities, and cities then pass those on to their municipalities. It's a regional system. One of the other things that we do is our wastewater, and then our transit. And transit needs to be looked at as a regional perspective as well. And one of the issues that we have is that if you were to make an elected Met Council, then things become very parochial, and you will have members, or this is just our perspective, is that you will have members who, rather than looking at the regional significance of things, will be more likely to go back and try to do things for their district. And I know that everyone here represents a particular district, and there are state legislators. I do have concerns about how that would work with regional perspectives regarding wastewater, land planning, regional parks, and so that gives me a little bit of pause as well. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. I know that this is this is an important issue to Senator Wieger, and I apologize that Chairman Bell couldn't be here today to discuss that as well. I did speak with the governor. The governor is comfortable with where the Met Council is today, and I know that there is some discussion as to how staggered terms would work. I think that would be interesting to further that conversation, but as far as the elected Met Council, we are opposing that as the council and the administration. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to take any of those.
Any questions for Mr. Shetman?
I do have one more point. I know that Senator Pappas asked about what the size of the of these districts would be, and it would be about 4.5 times the size of a House district and about 2.25 times the size of a Senate district. And the chair's salary is $58,000 a year. It is considered a part-time salary. The governor or the chair of the council is considered a member of the governor's cabinet. However, he receives almost half the pay of a general commissioner. So it is still considered a part-time job.
Well, thank you, Mr. Shetton. And I think this is perhaps these things travel on sort of parallel tracks with the belief that, at least from my perspective, that, you know, from a management standpoint, that the Metropolitan Council is fairly well run. And it is an organization that I take very seriously, and I think the legislature takes very seriously and is engaged with. On the other hand, this debate has been around for a long, long time about just the general idea that we ought to be able to elect folks that expend a budget that's that size. And so I don't think it's necessarily a reflection on this current council as much as it is about structure of government. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Also, I think, although it's a valid point to make about any elected group that represents a geographical area, that nevertheless they still have a responsibility to the entire region. And so those of us in the metropolitan area that represent metropolitan districts nevertheless have concern for the state as a whole, and we are state legislators as well as concerns about the needs of our individual districts. And I would expect an elected Met Council to have that dual responsibility, and I wouldn't be so concerned about it's a valid point, but it can be made about state legislators as well, as you did. But I would contend that we also rise beyond our districts, and I would expect an elected Met Council to do the same.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I absolutely agree. One of the points that I forgot to make earlier, that as far as regarding the council's ability to tax, we also come to the legislature virtually every year as a part of the tax bill. We have a provision in the public finance bill that deals with regional transit bonding. That is dollars that we pay to pay for the capital projects within the transportation system. And that metropolitan transportation system applies to the opt-out providers. It applies to the community-based providers in the, rural areas of the metropolitan area, and to the metropolitan transit system. That we come to the legislature every year to get that authority. It is debated. We bring forward a list of projects that has been worked out between all the different providers and come in, before both of the tax committees and the conference committees. And I believe that there is a lot of oversight that is included in that discussion. And I just wanted to point that out when I slipped up there for a minute. That's what I was trying to think of.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, if you could allow me, I have a couple questions. Senator Wieger, are the council members going to be running in the even year with us, or are they going to be running in the odd year with the local elected officials? Couldn't really find that.
Mr. Watson can help us with that.
Mr. Chairman, the schedule calls for calls for the first election to be in 2008, so they would be running in the even-numbered year.
Senator Pappas.
When legislators run. Okay.
Staggered term, so.
Yeah.
Some with.
Every 2 years.
Mr. Chairman, some with.
Senator Rust.
Member, only with the members of the House, mm-hmm. and some.
With both.
With the entire legislature.
So some in the first group would have just a 2-year term, mm-hmm. and then with, until we're on schedule. Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
I believe that this allows for a chair's salary to be set by the council, right? Senator Watson's nodding his head. Then I was just responding to a comment that Senator Wieger said about maybe that we should allow the chair's term to be 2 years instead of 1 year. That seems to make some sense.
But
Senator Rest.
Chairman, again, if I think there's this looking at, and I was doing that too, of looking at the model being the legislature rather than local governments. And I think local governments or county boards that choose their members, choose their officers, do so every year.
Every year.
Yeah. So I think that if that's supposed to be the comparative model, as you pointed out to start with, I think it doesn't mean they are unelected. It just means who will you have to have the confidence of the mm-hmm. of the council's members in order to retain the chairmanship.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Watson, does it mean, though, that if the members wanted a president or chair to serve a second term, he would be allowed to under current law, or is there a limit?
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, what we're looking at is the language on page 13 mm-hmm. in lines 30 and 31, and there's no term limit imposed there. It just says that the term is 1 year.
Okay, that's fine. Then they could be reelected. Okay, Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Pappas.
As I'm trying to understand the bill, and as far as I can see, and correct me if I'm wrong, that this legislation would have no effect on operations or when you come to the legislature for what authority. It's simply the method of choosing the members of the council. Is that correct, Senator Wieger?
Senator Wieger.
Chair, Senator Pappas, that's my intent.
Okay.
Senator Gerlach.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Wieger, you and I talked about the bill briefly, and I have more than just some concerns. I don't support it. And initially, years ago, when I was in the House, I remember this issue coming up. It has come up for years. And my initial first blush thought was, well, absolutely. This is the whole taxation without representation issue. But I think that was very simplistic. And as I, over the years, have dug deeper, I don't support this. It sounds like the governor switched his position. I think I've been consistent over the years and that I don't. And my there's a number of reasons. And one is that you if I could ask you this question, in my opinion, I think that legislative oversight of the Met Council and the operations of what happens in the metropolitan area will be lessened by this, because once someone is elected, they become their own entity. It's their own. They have their own constituency that now will fight to protect. I think the parochialism issue is real. Certainly, we struggle with that here and try to balance that, but it's real. And we have the issue about the local control debates. A lot of the cities will say, our cities and our counties and our school boards will say, leave us alone, this local control. We are elected. Let us do what we are elected to do. So if we had an elected Met Council, I think that we would have the same then that pushback from the Met Council saying, we are elected. Let us do what we are elected to do. Stay out of our business. And then we as the legislature now have just said, we have essentially abrogated a lot of our control, authority, power, whatever you want, that we're now sending that to a different body. We're acquiescing that. And I'm not sure I want to do that. But in your opinion, are we not, as a legislature, giving up authority and power to another elected body?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gerlach, absolutely not. What we are doing, we're empowering people. Right now, the governor is the one who has the accountability model with the members that are appointed. I think that's way too political. And what happens, a Democratic governor is probably going to put a lot more Democrats on, and to perhaps not serving the public's best interest by removing Republicans that may have been qualified. And the same for Republicans being put on that may have replaced good Democrats. It should not be based on that party loyalty, but in fact it has in several appointments. So I don't want that dimension in the process. I want the accountability to go to the public in that district. And just as we have to go before our voters and county commissioners and others that are elected, so would they. And the reason, again, for the taxation as well as the increased power. Power, that, as you observed, is put in statute by the legislature, and we still would have oversight, just as we discuss expectations of schools, of counties, and other local governmental entities. So we would not be losing our authority there. What we're doing on the accountability is empowering the people in the metropolitan area to better shape their destiny.
Mr. Chairman, I guess we might have to disagree. I think that the legislature is ceding authority to another, you know, other folks that will have their own interests, their own constituencies, their own, you know, kingdoms or fiefdoms, so to speak, that they will. But I would like to pursue a little bit on the political side of this, because I'm wondering now. I've always thought the Met Council is supposed to be about implementing policy, and certainly to a certain degree, you know, they facilitate development of some policy. But when it comes to the big issues, they're not supposed to be a political platform. You know, it's supposed to be about implementing policy. If they're elected, I think we shift from policy implementers. I mean, they have that, but I think we open up a big Pandora's box of a whole lot of political stuff that happens. And I see that in Section 17, the intent is to have these Met Council members run as nonpartisan. That's what I'm reading here. So they would be part of the nonpartisan world of candidates. Is that your intent?
Senator Wieger.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gerlach, in terms of the concern about political stuff, I'm not sure we are all elected in a political process, and how well we do determines how the public evaluates us. The council is not so much an implementer as a group that puts together the vision for this area through the blueprint, through a series of hearings and with the local officials, et cetera. And they're in a process of updating different chapters of that blueprint for the area. But it means they have to work closely with local governmental officials, with the public as well. And then there is some teeth in different areas, and maybe additional things need to be addressed by the legislature. But I'm not concerned that this is going to be more political. I'm concerned it's too political right now in a gubernatorial process. Not against any of the individuals, they're fine, but the thing that has bothered me is seeing some cases good Democrats or good Republicans replaced under a committee system that reviewed, but people that were replaced just out of other connections. Let the public decide.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Gerlach.
It looks like that. The bill says that they're going to run as not. Senator Wieger, it looks like the intent here is that that they'll run as nonpartisan office seekers.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Senator,
without party designation.
Yes.
There's a raging debate now about parties endorsing other, you know, people on the ballot. They don't get the designation on the ballot, but party endorsements of judicial candidates. And the argument for that is to provide voters with information, to let people know something about these people, because nobody seems to follow that closely. I can just see that although they will be not the party won't be designated on the ballot, that this is of significant importance enough that there's no question that political parties are going to be involved in these elections, and that they would most likely do endorsements. Have you anticipated this at all? I think it becomes more political. Have you anticipated anything about the party politics being involved in this?
Senator Wicker.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Gerlach, potentially they would weigh in, and not just the two major parties. I imagine the Green Party would have an interest in growth and policies, but I'd like to ask Senator Orfield to expand on the concern.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, Senator. I think these are really important and fundamental questions, and they relate to sort of all governmental bodies. You know, if you look at the Federalist Papers and the founding of the country, the framers sort of debated this question, whether the Senate ought to be elected or whether it ought to be appointed. The framers thought they discussed the problems of parties and the problems of factions, and they thought they were very great evils, but they thought that democracy was more important and that if bodies tax and spend, they should be accountable. This is a principle that goes back to the founding. Local governments, particularly those that have general purposes, those that make policy decisions, should be accountable. Now, a county, all local governments, in terms of legal theory, are creatures of the legislature. They're all changeable at will. Counties in Minnesota have a constitutional status, and there's some constitutional provisions. But all of the local governments are creatures of the state legislature. All their taxing powers are defined at will by the legislature. The council is no different than this. It's circumscribed by the legislature. All local governments are. But in America, since the founding, things that tax tremendously and have discretionary policy decisions over multifaceted issues have been chosen to be elected, and it's a value of the country and all local. Now, you could make the county appointed if you would want to. You could make the cities appointed if you would want to. You could make the school boards appointed if you would want to. It's within the power of the legislature, but generally they don't do that in the United States. Local governments are accountable to people, particularly those that tax and spend.
Did you have a follow-up, Senator Gerlach?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I had one more question about the way some of the the campaign finance.
Senator Gerlach.
And then I'll wrap up here. Mr. Chairman, Senator Wicker, it looks like, you know, I know with campaign finance laws, we have the federal world governed by the FEC. We have our state-level offices handled by the campaign finance board, and we have our local offices, which are a separate deal, and our PCR program applies to that state level, which are all partisan. It looks like with the bill, you're trying to do a hybrid. You're kind of piggybacking on the model of the public financing with the PCR access to the PCR program, with being nonpartisan and essentially a local office. And my question is the PCR money that's allocated, you know, through the Department of Revenue, but that's state money and it goes for statewide elections. Under this, maybe Mr. Orfield will know the detail of this, it looks like we're going to have statewide taxpayers paying for these metro elections. So, for example, someone in our community, Senator Gimsey, you're going to have residents of Wilmer whose state tax dollars go into the Department of Revenue and then are used through these PCR refunds to finance campaigns in the metro area, which I have nothing to do with. Am I reading this correctly? And where do these public funds for these campaigns are coming from?
Senator Wicker, Mr. Orfield. Is it?
If this is the same bill that was introduced in the 10 years ago, and I haven't looked at this provision, I think they are statewide funds. I think that, and that was a decision. I think that some people were in favor of the council if it were elected without public financing. I think this was one of the issues that divided the legislature a little bit, was the public financing thing. I think there was reasonably broad support for it to be elected, but I think these were I think that I think you're right in that.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, the $20,000 in subsidy for those candidates who take spending limits, that comes from the Met Council's property tax account.
Okay.
Right. So I don't really see the language about the rebate.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's because if they're linked into the PCR program, they're allowed to get the PCR refunds to their contributors.
Well, are they?
That would,
Mr. Watson,
I think
they?
That's in the bill. Where did I see that?
Mr. Chairman, yes, they are linked. It's actually in the first section where a candidate for purposes of Chapter 10A is defined to include a candidate who is a candidate for the Metropolitan Council. And all those candidates, as defined in 10A01 sub 10, then are eligible to participate in the PCR program, except that judicial candidates may not.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, if we wanted to keep in the bill the public subsidy for Met Council candidates as an elected body, but not permit them to, just like people running for the county board do not participate in, and they don't participate in public subsidy either, but
They could create their own program.
They could create their own program, but if we wanted to eliminate the participation in the PCR program, what kind of amendment would be needed?
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I think one way to do it would be to amend Section 290.06, Subdivision 23, which is not currently in the bill. And in the language there that says a candidate for purposes of the PCR program is a candidate as defined in this Subdivision 10, except for a judicial candidate, you'd add, except for a candidate for the Metropolitan Council.
So, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Watson, it would not be enough just to eliminate the language in 10A here, sub 10, in lines 25 and 26?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, the problem with doing it that way is that it would eliminate these Met Council candidates from the other parts of the campaign finance program, where there's a contribution limit and a spending limit and reporting requirements.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would like to offer an amendment that speaks to my first point where we'd have to bring in that section of the law in, what is it, 209?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, it's Section 290.06, Subdivision 23.
And Mr. Watson, if that's something, is that something that you can do here while we move to other testifiers?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While that's being drafted up, and that's fine, I'm not going to offer an amendment like that, but Senator Rest is, mm-hmm. and I would support that.
I think it's a good point.
But I still don't support the bill, and I just wanted to sum up what I think here. I think the arguments for it are the taxation without representation. They have a large budget, these sorts of things. However, I still feel that the legislature is ceding authority to another group. I think that there will be more parochialism. I think we're injecting more politics into a body that should be focused on the regional planning and the infrastructure, the transit operations, and implementing things. I think we're going to get blocks of people coalescing. I'm wondering just out loud on that, with the way the districts are drawn, there's a concentration. I mean, I represent a suburban district now, but I mean, you're going to have Minneapolis, St. Paul have a lot more Met Council members as a block. Am I, as a suburban person, a resident, suddenly a permanent minority voice on a Met Council then? I'm not, you know, I think that that's a real possibility. We're going to have political parties weighing in on this, which may be good, may be bad. I guess I'm not sure about that. We have some of the subsidy issues. Now we're going to be using property tax dollars to fund campaigns. I just think overall, members of the committee, my opinion is that I'm not prepared to go this route for those reasons. I don't think the gain balances out on some of the negatives. And I think that Senator Wigger is making a lot of good, valid points, and there's a lot of it's a good democracy debate for the classroom. but I just wanted to say that I'm not supportive of this. Even if we'll do the amendment, I'll support the amendment, but I wouldn't support the bill. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Senator Gerlach, and I think you've raised a very important point that's resulting in an amendment by Senator Rest. And I think you're right that if this bill is to pass and is signed by the governor, there will be a change in the culture, and we will see a difference in how county government or metropolitan government is implemented. And, I guess time would tell if that will be a positive or a negative outcome. But I think that we're having a good discussion here, and on that level, we've heard from everyone who signed up to testify. Are there others that would like to testify, members of the public? I know that former Senator Orfield wanted to make a final comment, but if you'd like to testify, please prepare to come forward in one moment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to point out that if the council were elected, it would be about 70% suburban in its representation, 70-something percent. So the central cities would have a voice, but it would be not as large as the suburbs, and different suburbs have different issues.
Well, thank you, Mr. Orfield. We in the suburbs have proven over time to never really be able to vote in a block, so we're not very good at voting in a block, us in the suburbs. So we're not relieved by that. Are there others in the audience that would like to testify either in favor or in opposition to this bill? I don't see anybody else coming forward. Is there further discussion within the committee?
Yeah, does Mr. Watson have my amendment?
Well, thank you, Senator Rest. You're right. We don't want to move on without adopting the amendment, or at least considering the amendment for adoption.
Right. Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Watson.
As you can see, the amendment is on its way down to the typist, but again, to restate it, it would be on page 12. After line 5, insert a new section to read section 23, Minnesota Statutes 2006, section 290.06, subdivision 23 is amended to read. Then we would be reproducing the entire section. And in the definition of candidate that's in there, which now says candidate means a candidate as defined in section 10A.01 subdivision 10, except a candidate for judicial office, period. Before the period, we would insert or the Metropolitan Council.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
I would submit that is clear enough without having to wait for the typist to come back, even though we don't have that section of the law in front of us.
I agree with Senator Rest. Does anyone have concerns about that? Seeing none, Senator Rest moves the amendment that was verbally given to us by Mr. Watson. All those in favor of the amendment indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Are there further, again, is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify? Seeing no one coming forward, is there further discussion within the subcommittee? Seeing Senator Rest.
I would move the bill be recommended.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Senator Rest moves that Senate file. Senator Rest moves that Senate file number 81 be recommended to pass and as amended and be referred to the full committee on state and local government operations and oversight. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor of that motion indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman.
Bill passed. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to remind the members and the members of the public that there is a glass wall that surrounds the table and members. Mr. Shetman, your conversation with Senator Pappas is inappropriate.
Thank you, Senator Rest, for reminding us of that, and I think that is important for both senators and members of the public to understand that it's difficult for us to have interactions when members are at the table. Thank you, Senator Wiegert and Mr. Arfield.
Thank you.
And Senator Wiegert, you have another bill here on the are you still – I know that you were due be in North Branch. Do you wish to proceed?
I'll highlight it, Mr. Chair, and depending on your appetite, we'll see if it's a short one or further discussion at another time.
Senate file number 23, Senator Wiegert.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senate file 23 addresses what might be changed if there's a vacancy for a United States senator. Right now, if that happens in Minnesota, it's an appointment by the governor. This bill would call for a special election. In fact, a special election would be called for if there was a vacancy for you, for a state rep, or someone in Congress, but not for the U.S. Senate. So I thought for consistency we would have that. And I have an A2 amendment that puts it in the form that I would like.
Chairman, I'll move the A2 amendment, the author's amendment.
Senator Rest moves the A2 amendment, the author's amendment. Any further discussion of the amendment? All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Senator Wiegert.
And, Mr. Chair, I'd also, on the same subject, thought, well, what if there was a vacancy for Attorney General or Auditor or Secretary of State? That's an appointment as well, but was not able to put an amendment here on that because it would need a change in the Constitution. So if you're wondering, that's in the Constitution. If I could ask Senate Counsel Mr. Watson, who prepared this, if he would just like to comment on why we have the days in here. We have the amount of time for the special elections, and basically it gives a little more time, and it was also based on consultation with the Secretary of State's office, or if there's any questions on the number of days. But the principle here is that there be an election if there is a vacancy for a United States senator, as opposed to an appointment.
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, the bill as introduced simply added the office of U.S. senator to those that are elected in a special election. And some of you might have been elected in a special election. No? Nobody here?
Oh, Senator Gerlach.
Yeah.
Yes, you are, Senator Gerlach. Mr. Watson.
So it would be the same procedure for a U.S. Senate seat. What the amendment did was lengthen the time for those special elections, basically twice what it is now. Instead of having a primary with a notice of at least 7 days, the notice of the primary would be at least 14, and the time between the primary and the general election, instead of being at least 14 days, would be at least 28. No more than. So the maximum time to get a vacancy filled, which under current law is 33 days, would become 54 days under the new law. So it's adding 21 more days of time to that election cycle. That, as I said, is a maximum time. It is not a minimum time.
Senator Rest.
So, Mr. Chairman and Senator Wiegert, with the amendment, that applies to all special elections, not just for U.S. Senate. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, that's correct. That's my understanding.
Senator Wiegert, did you have further?
No, it was brought on, I think, when there was the near death of the Dakota senator. Was wondering what would happen in Minnesota and thought the public should decide if there's ever a case. It's too important for an appointment.
Senator Wiegert and maybe Mr. Watson can help us with this. With the delete all amendment that we've adopted, what can you and maybe Mr. Watson, if you could walk us through the first set of time frames that occurs when a vacancy occurs. An issue has been raised with me on actually a different level as it relates to county vacancies, about the discomfort that units of government have had when they have a vacancy due to a death, if in case a vacancy is due to a death, in that oftentimes that period of declaration of a vacancy occurs perhaps on the day of a funeral or other circumstances that has created, at least I know some county folks, to desire a discussion about change. Can you tell us how that plays in this delete everything amendment in terms of the time frame when in which the vacancy is declared?
Mr. Chairman, both under current law and under the law as it would read with this amendment, the governor has no more than 5 days to issue, after the vacancy occurs, to issue a writ setting a date for a special election. I should back up maybe and say that in some cases under current law for the legislature and for Congress, there need not be a special election. That is, if the legislature is not going to be meeting or if Congress is not going to be meeting, we're in the last year of a term and there's a general election coming up in the fall and the vacancy occurs at a time, say there was a vacancy in June and there's no special session anticipated, then there could be no need for a special election that would just be held at the general election in November because there's no need to fill the vacancy.
Senator Rest.
But more often it happens that the vacancy occurs around the time of the election as a result of people getting elected to one thing or another. And so there is some urgency to get that vacancy filled, and that's when these timetables all come into play. And the requirement for the governor to issue the writ within 5 days, and then under the new law there would be a primary within 14 days and a general election 28 days after that.
Senator Rest.
I answered my own question.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wigger, do you know how other states handle this issue?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, different ways, and I don't have, I think I asked the National Conference, state legislatures for some feedback, and I didn't get that yet, but I will forward something. It all depends on the state. Usually it's gubernatorial appointment, but not always. But what I did learn is there's many states where you have senators that are not the same party as the governor. Works both ways, Democrat, Republican, and it's an awkward situation.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
I recall that it, maybe this is an error, but in some states the it's an appointment process, but the person appointed has to be of the same party as the person whose resignation or death or something caused the special election to be necessary, or the appointment to be necessary. Does that sound familiar to you, Senator Wigger, or am I just imagining that?
Senator Wigger.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I think that most states would like to see that, but I haven't seen it codified too many places. That's why I was waiting for the National Conference report. So this just puts it to the people again.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Senator Wigger, it would also be interesting to just see the history in Minnesota when we've had appointments. You know, why? I mean, Muriel Humphrey comes to mind, but I'm sure there were probably others. Yeah. Governor Anderson, he got appointed.
Yes, when United States Senator Mondale went and to vice presidency, and
that was why
triggered that whole episode of events.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is an extremely important issue and change, and I support it in concept and am prepared to vote for it, but I really would like to, before it moves out of the subcommittee, to get more information, and that Senator Wigger has requested from NCSL, and so I would request that we lay the bill over.
Senator Rest, that's probably a good idea. I think the need for more information is apparent, and so we will lay the bill over and wait for that information to come forward and consider it in the future.
Thank you very much.
Senator Wicker, thank you. Senator Sharon. Senator Sharon is on her way to the committee. Be here shortly. Be taking up Senate file number 208. Draw attention that as Senator Sharon is making her way here, that there are, I have two amendments,
I think I'm going to move the amendments.
Technical amendment and a more substantive amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
We're waiting for her. I think we can, we have the bill in front of us, and we could probably go ahead and get the bill in the shape we know that going to be discussed, so I would move the A2 amendment.
Senator Rest moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
The A4 amendment.
Senator Rest moves the A4 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A4 amendment is adopted. Senator Sharon, welcome to the Subcommittee on Elections. We have begun by, the committee has adopted both of the amendments that were author's amendments for your information, and look forward to hearing the bill. Senator Sharon.
For my clarification, Chair Larson, the two amendments that were passed were focused on, I think there may be three amendments, so I have to make sure. Is this amendment, are we talking about this amendment has been passed?
A2. Yeah,
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Senator Rest.
I'm now looking back at the A4 amendment, and I'm trying to figure out how it works, Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, just to get back to Senator Sharon's question, the amendment that you and I discussed is the one that was adopted.
It has been adopted.
That's been adopted. And the other one was the amendment to strike that paragraph B in Section 1.
And that has been passed as well. Okay, thank you very much.
Yes.
So then I don't need to go through this amendment.
Senator Rest.
So the effect of striking lines 14 to 18 on page 1 is to just delete that section from the statute. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, no.
Okay. Well, then I need more explanation.
There is not very much left in Section 1 after doing that, but what is left is the important sentence that will say, starting on line 8 and finishing on line 13, any eligible voter may vote by absentee ballot as provided in Section 203B.04 to 0.15.
Mr. Chairman, subdivision.
The reason for the striking the language in lines 8 to 13 that was already in the bill was to take out those several different excuses that a person had to give in order to be able to vote by absentee ballot. This bill was drafted based on the one that was introduced 2 years ago. What happened last year was that paragraph B was added to provide an additional reason authorizing people to vote by absentee ballot. But if the thrust of the bill is to say you don't have to have any reason, then the language of paragraph B can be stricken.
So, Mr. Chairman, so all of subdivision 1 then reads, any eligible voter may vote by absentee ballot as provided in those sections, and that's the entire thing.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, that's
just
correct.
Just trying to make sure I understand what we did there. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
Well, thank you very much, Chair Larson. I am happy to be here to present a bill that really expands the ways in which people can participate in their government by, if they select to vote by absentee ballot. And that is the essence of what is in front of you today for consideration. With the amendments that have been presented to you, what is happening under this legislation is that people will be able to vote by absentee ballot without having to create a reason or an excuse for that. And it also creates the capacity for people to select an agent of delivery so that they are able to receive an application for the ballot by asking someone to serve in that capacity for them. And those are the two essential things about this that offer more flexibility to the voter.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Did you have testifiers that I know I'm looking for my agenda here? Did you have testifiers that you wanted to have go first, Senator Sharon?
Yes, there are testifiers who are here today. Do you have a list of their names?
I do. Mr. Carl Knutson is on our list. Mr. Knutson, come forward.
I think he's to a specific amendment.
Oh, this is gone.
I'm sorry?
I think he's for a specific amendment.
Oh.
It wasn't deleted. It just struck us.
It's to... Oh, and it's an amendment that is coming, is Senator Marty. Okay. Well, why don't we wait then, Mr. Knutson, if you're going to testify to an amendment that apparently is coming. Mai Thor from the Minnesota Disability Law Center. Thank you, Ms. Thor. Please state your name for the record. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mai Thor, and I'm representing the Voting Rights Coalition and the Minnesota Disability Law Center. I'd like to start off by just thanking Senator Sharon for authoring this bill, which will prove to be really important for people with disabilities throughout the state regarding agent delivery of absentee ballots. The Voting Rights Coalition and the Minnesota Disability Law Center, along with the Minnesota Senior Federation, are in support of this bill. As far as the disability-specific side of this issue, approximately 832,000 individuals in Minnesota identify themselves as disabled. That's about 16% of the 5.2 million people who live in Minnesota. Of this 832,000, only a little over 11,000 individuals live in a group home or a supported living situation, or they live with their families or foster care. So many of the remaining 820,000 individuals live in other kinds of situations. Mainly they live alone. So this bill would help ensure that the individuals who are disabled will be able to obtain an absentee ballot through the assistance of an agent. And I also think that the timeliness of this bill couldn't be better, considering that within the coming years, the senior population is going to be at its largest, probably causing more people with disabilities to be within our communities. So I would appreciate your support, Mr. Chair, for this bill, encourage the community support as well for Senate File 208. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thor. I also had, are there any questions? Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Thor, I don't know who came up with the language on the A2 amendment, but I was curious because I haven't seen us use the terms frail or elderly in a bill like this in a long time. Is there a reason we don't simply define it as somebody who's homebound or disabled? Is frail or elderly bringing? Do you know where the language came from?
Ms. Thor.
This language was discussed amongst the Voting Rights Coalition, and we wanted to be inclusive of people who are not living in facilities or group homes that are already included in statute that can take advantage of this opportunity. And so... you know, if we want to change the language later to be a little bit better and more politically correct, we can certainly do that. Under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, you know, there is a definition of, you know, people who are considered disabled. And so, you know, we want to make sure that the word disabled is in there. But, you know, this was something that the Voting Rights Coalition decided upon.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Sharon, maybe I'd like to talk to you maybe before full committee. Maybe somebody who would have a difficulty of, or health or whatever reasons of getting to the polls, and I don't mind using the word disabled. I think we should. I just think there might be a more artful way to describe this, and I'll talk with Senator Sharon before full committee about that, because that's just technical thing. I just don't know that that's the best choice of wording.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, as the chair of the full committee, I'd rather do the work in the subcommittee and fix it here, Senator Marty. And it seems to me that I'm not sure that it's a matter of being politically correct as being so much a matter of being specific as to the population that we are wanting to include. And you mentioned the Human Rights Act, and I wonder if the voters, Mr. Watson, whether we could reference voters by a reference to statute in the same way, Senator Sharon, as you reference assisted living residents by Chapter 144G, which is a chapter on assisted living. And Mr. Watson, is there a way of referencing a definition by a reference to a statute rather than having to assume that we know what frail and elderly means?
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I don't know what it would be.
Mr. Chairman?
Are those terms, Mr. Chairman, or Senator Marty, are those terms that you would know from your experience in your committee, Senator Marty, are those terms anywhere defined who we
Mr.
mean
Mr. Chairman,
by?
Frail is an unusual choice of word. Let me suggest an amendment that would be delete the new language and say insert on line 19 to a voter who would have difficulty going to the polls for reasons of health or disability.
Mr. Watson, did you get that, and does that accomplish what we're trying to do here? And Senator Rest, is that?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's better language and more general.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Ms. Thor.
Senator Rest, when I was consulting others for the language for this, I talked to some representative from the State Council on Disability as well, and similar to Senator Marty's wording, we also thought of leaving the word disabled in there because that is within the, you know, that's defined within the Minnesota Human Rights Act, but then also just using the terms unable to leave your home. That's certainly an option that we would be agreeable to as far as the Minnesota Disability Law Center. But I don't know about the Voting Rights Coalition.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, I understand the reason for using the word disabled. So I'm going to just suggest something, and then maybe if it's right, maybe Senate Council can put up the wording better. But to a voter who is disabled or who would have difficulty going to the polls for health reasons, because I think the point here is we can – I don't think you want to be just somebody who's homebound, somebody who may be able to get out of their house on a good weather day, may have difficulty going to the polls because of health reasons. I just would prefer that to the frail language. And if that Ms. Thor wants to have the disabled as a separate category because it is defined.
So, Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty and Senator Sharon, I guess I'm more comfortable with that, too, because someone could then, you know, say affirmatively for any number of reasons that they have difficulty going to the polls for health reasons, and it's not just a matter of being frail or old. keeping that separate from saying disabled, which again does have a statutory at least definition somewhere. Support that change of language and wonder whether Senator Sharon is okay with that.
Senator Sharon.
Peter.
Chair Larson, in that language, do you see that that would be comprehensive enough to consider one of the situations that Senator Marty was referring to, that if a person is elderly and in their, or has some, is not considered disabled, but mobility is an issue and it's snowing or the weather is problematic or something that would not really fit the disability or health-related issue, would still have access to the use of an agent for delivery of a ballot. I think that's why that language is there, is that it tries to acknowledge that there are things besides health status and disability that might create a barrier to getting to the polls for someone.
Senator Rest.
Well, Mr. Chairman, actually, I don't think so, because if someone who is elderly and has fear for their health, if they leave home on a slippery day, I think that's a health reason, maybe related to their age, but it is certainly a health reason and would encompass issues related to age. And Mr. Chairman, if we did adopt that amendment, we'd have to adopt it also on lines 32 and 33.
Mr. Chairman?
Correct, Senator Rest. Senator Pappas.
I just want to clarify that I'm assuming this would also cover situations, say, of a pregnant woman at the advanced stage of her pregnancy or a newborn mom. Sure. Would that be considered health reasons? Because it would be the same thing, afraid to fall and injure herself.
That's the way I would see it, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Senator Rest, the chair agrees as well that that's the intent. Maybe Mr. Watson can give us a restatement of Senator Marty's amendment that accomplishes that.
Mr. Chairman, on page 1, line 19, delete is frail, elderly, homebound, comma, or, and insert, would have difficulty getting to the polls because of health reasons, comma, or who is.
Does everyone have
line?
Very good.
32, delete is frail, elderly, comma, and on line 33, delete homebound, comma, or disabled, homebound, comma, or, and insert who would have difficulty getting to the polls because of health reasons, comma, or
is
who is.
Same. Senator Marty, that is agreeable to you. Senator Marty makes the motion that was stated by Senate counsel. Is there any further discussion regarding the amendment? Is that agreeable to you, Senator Sharon?
Yes, it is.
Very good. All those in favor of Senator Marty's motion indicate by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, I don't know if you have other witnesses, but on line 131 of the A2 amendment, the reason why you are moving the period at which the agent may deliver the ballots from 4 days to 7 days, what problem does that solve?
It allows for more flexibility. It gives the person more time. And to find the agent, to get the agent's schedule managed, to be able to have somebody be responsive to them.
Yeah, Mr. Senator Chairman, Senator Sharon, do we have instances of where they were not able to do it in 4 days?
Senator Sharon.
This was a recommendation that came from the county agents that are overseeing this ballot, so I'm assuming that it comes from their recommendation.
Thank you very much. It's very helpful.
Is there further questions? I know that there are others that have
signed up to testify. However, I've received a note from the Secretary of State's office, Beth Frazier, who was here intending to testify and had to leave for a meeting that couldn't be changed, and she wanted me to relay to, for the record, that Secretary of State Mark Ritchie is strongly in favor of this legislation and wanted me to read that in place of her being able to testify. Are there other folks, people in the crowd, in the audience that would like to testify either in favor or in opposition to the bill? Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I have an amendment.
Senator Marty has an amendment.
A3 amendment.
We have that.
And while it's being distributed, I will briefly explain it.
The amendment will be passed out here shortly. Senator Marty.
We have a provision in law right now where if you are regularly out of town on election day or regularly expect to be, and there are some occupations often in transportation field like railroad or perhaps airline where people are going to be out of town regularly, where they can get an absentee ballot application each time. But this where Mr. Knutson wanted to testify, because a lot of the railroad people he works with are out of town for a month at a time, then they're in town for a few days. And if they come into town for 2 days in mid-October and they then get an application at their house and they send it back and they're not back in town, they're not going to be able to vote. This would be that if you're on regular, one of the people on the list for absentee ballots regularly, that you could get an absentee ballot mailed to you if you chose to sign up for that instead of the application, because you're doing it every 2 years anyway. And I'd like to have Mr. Knutson speak to that briefly.
Mr. Knutson, and then Senator Sharon as well. Mr. Knutson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carl Knutson. I'm with the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees, and we are the people that build and maintain railroad tracks. With the mergers that have been through, that have produced about five to six major railroads in the country, the people that I represent wind up traveling incredible distances. Our people tend to start work in Texas, Oklahoma, or Kansas in about March, work their way north during the summer. They're here during the summer, and they head back south and wind up in, by the time election rolls around, they're usually in southern Kansas again or somewhere in Nebraska. They work a 410-hour day, and so they get a 40-hour week. But Friday is driving home. Saturday is as we phrase it, hug the kids, kiss the wife, grab the mail, and head back south, back in the truck heading south. If there's something in the mail, if there's a ballot in the mail, they're much more likely to vote than if they have to go through the application process. Section 203B.04, subsection 6, which is being amended, was added by the 2005 legislature. Some of you were on the elections committee at that time. And it was modeled on the Washington State application or Washington State process. The word in a compromise in the House, the word application was added to the bill. The amendment that Senator Marty is proposing would restore it to the original language that was introduced in 2005. As I said, it's modeled on the Washington State language, where 65% to 70% of the people vote by absentee ballot, and they have Senator Sharon's amendment in Washington State, they do not require a reason for the being absent. Four states do this right now with permanent absentee ballot: California, Washington, Oregon, and Alaska. And the experience has been very positive. To my knowledge, everyone in the labor movement that I've spoken to supports this. And I know that the AFL, as is part of the AFL-CIO, as part of the Voting Rights Coalition, and which supports this bill. And I'll stand for questions if you have any.
Any questions for Mr. Knutson? Senator Sharon, you've had a chance to look at the amendment.
Yes, I've just had a chance, and I've had conversations on this before. May I ask some questions?
Sure, absolutely.
Thank you, Chair Larson. I know that the content of the amendment that I have presented to you without this amendment has had some review from the Secretary of State's office and others who are impacted by the amendment. I'm uncertain about that, so I'd ask who has had a chance to see this amendment and have a chance to tell us what, if any, implications there are that we haven't thought of about it.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, I got this from Senator Higgins today because she was not going to be presenting her bill today. She withdrew her bill. But and I'm not sure who all they did, so maybe we can ask if witnesses would know who.
I know there are a number of elections officials in the audience. If someone would like to, would feel compelled to come forward and testify, we'd welcome the input.
May I speak to this for a moment?
Mr. Knutson.
Yes. To my knowledge, the Secretary of State's office supports this, as does the Voting Rights Coalition. The technical problems that, if any, have been worked out in other states, and Washington State, for one reason we chose that as a model, is that it's very similar in size in population to this state, and has issues that are similar in terms of voting. For example, weather. Just prior to the last, the 2006 election, there was major storms in Washington State, and the Secretary of State made the point that many people who would otherwise have been unable to get to the polls had already voted by absentee ballot, so the storms did not impact the election. And for those of you who've lived in Minnesota more than one winter, realize that we occasionally have snow on Election Day. Or as the one I cite is the 1991 Halloween blizzard. That would, if that had happened on Election Day, it would have greatly reduced the turnout. So I would ask for your support for this, and I'll stand for somebody else to testify.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Chair Larson. I now that I understand that this is a part of a bill that Senator Higgins was considering presenting on the same subject, I know that that she would have pursued this, and I'm willing to accept this amendment.
Was there, Senator Sharon, there are others in the audience that would like to testify? I think that's important to hear from them.
Mr. Chairman, I think we need to hear from the elections officials if there would be any issues with any difficulty in making this as part of the system.
I'm interested in that as well, Senator Rust. I think it appears to me that the application process is part of the accountability process here. Please state your name for the record, and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Rachel Smith. I'm the election director for Anoka County, and this is the first time I've had an opportunity to review it today. There are some initial concerns. I'm certainly not here to speak for it or against it. I'm just a little concerned that we might be sending ballots to people that may be deceased, or that we may, because remember, the ongoing or the permanent list of individuals includes more people than just those that are not here with, or are out of town or traveling due to work. So we would have some initial concerns and probably would want to do some research and get back to you and report some more factual statistics. So we would know what we were sending out to.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Mm-hmm. Senator Rust.
Well, in the if you have the amendment in front of you, Section 4 of the beginning at line 13 talks about the termination of that ongoing absentee status, saying that it ends on, current law ends on, to get the application, ends on the voter's written request or death or whatever. And Senator Marty, do you, or Mr. Watson, do you remember when, again, when this was done? I think the witness said 2005, so we certainly would have had some experience with applications, I would think, in for 2006 or maybe other elections following the adoption of this. So has that been a problem with applications of, you know, the status ends when the application was undeliverable or the ballot was undeliverable or the voter died or whatever?
Ms. Smith?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, we have traditionally operated the permanent illness or disability, which is in subdivision 5 there. That is what we've had a more traditional view, or it, that's been the traditional absentee, more permanent absentee ballot application. Section 6, I believe, was recently added, and we would only had one election to go through. What we're doing, if someone is either ongoing or permanent, we're sending applications only. And frequently under both of those programs, we are deleting or removing voters from those processes due to sometimes we send them to nursing homes and they come back and the program administrator has told us that they're, you know, they're deceased or they're no longer living there.
Senator Rest.
So, Mr. Chairman, my question's the same. So it would be, You do have experience with termination of the ongoing absentee status. I mean, because you must have done something under the permanent illness or disability in paragraph A to not continue that, even if the language from line 14 on was only adopted in 2005. I mean, what did you do before sub 6 was added to the law? Do you understand my question? I don't mean to be confusing.
Ms. Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, yes, we removed them due to deceased, and these, of course, were applications that were being sent out. I don't have a position either way on this. I think that what I'm saying is that I would want some time to be able to present some form of numbers to you so you knew how many people we were sending to applications to, and how many were being returned. I don't have numbers on that with me today, so I wouldn't know how many. In this case, my concern would be how many ballots are we sending, and how many are we getting returned to us.
Well, then, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Rest,
Senator Marty, you know we're going to have other elections bills that come before us, to which this amendment would be germane without any problem. I mean, it would be germane in the committee anyway, but that it would fit in some other bills. Wonder if you'd consider withdrawing it and getting some more information from the election clerks and then seeing if it would be appropriate to bring it back up on another occasion.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I think that's a good idea. I was handed this by my suite mate this afternoon because she was not coming down here. And I think it would be helpful for Ms. Smith and other election officials to get us more information. So I will withdraw it for now, and we can consider it on another bill.
Senator Marty withdraws his amendment, and hopefully folks who are interested in this issue and have thoughts about it can share those with all of us in the coming days. Senator Marty.
However, I do have another amendment, Mr. Chairman. The A5 amendment, which I wanted to incorporate a little change into, and this is one that deals with absentee voting as well. Right now, a lot of people, I've heard this is an issue for some in the military, for some people overseas, and I think this would make it much more consistent with what we do for in certain rural communities where you have mail ballot elections where you must vote by mail. In effect, what this does, the A5 amendment, and as soon as it's handed out, I'll read the change I like incorporated into it. But what this would do is, if you're pre-registered, right now you are required to get another person registered to vote in Minnesota, or a notary Minnesota notary to administer an oath saying that the ballots were displayed to the individual unmarked and that they marked them in the voter's present, in the individual's presence, and so on. That's the way we do it for all of them. And for people serving overseas, I talked with one person who's in Japan right now, a Minnesota resident who in a smaller town, apparently, and whether in that person's unit or whatever, they weren't sure if they had anybody else who was registered in Minnesota. So the person said, well, I was registered there when I went to college, and is that person still registered? There's a lot of confusion over it. And so the issue, what I would incorporate here on page, on lines 17 and 18, would be, instead of the words that are there now, the new language would read, if the voter is not pre-registered, comma, and the witness requirement, I remember this issue has come up in the past a number of times before. I don't think we've ever offered it for only for those who are pre-registered, which I think is an important distinction. But that, again, right now, if I'm in a small community where I'm registered and they vote by mail, they send the thing to me. I'm not getting a witness to do it. It's not actually as big of a problem in a small town, perhaps, but if you are serving in the military overseas somewhere, it may be a significant problem to know. And when I've talked with election officials in the past, who checks these things to make sure the witness is a registered voter? Because it's a registered voter anywhere in the state. And frankly, there is no system in place. It's not a check and balance to make sure there's no fraud. It accomplishes, it's in effect, I could have somebody else sign who's not a registered voter or who's not sure if they're a registered voter, which I think is often what the problem is. But this would make it consistent with the way it is for people who vote by mail ballot. You mail it in. And so I would move the A5 amendment as with those wording change incorporated.
And then could you read that again?
It would read, the new language would read, if the voter is not pre-registered, comma.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, might I suggest we use the same wording as is in line 25, if the voter was not previously registered?
That's what I would like to use.
Senator Marty would like to incorporate that into his amendment. So Mr. Watson, could you read for us what the new language would then read, starting on line 17?
Mr. Chairman, it would read, if the voter was not previously registered, the certificate shall also contain a statement, et cetera.
Senator Marty moves that amendment. Is there discussion regarding the amendment? Senator Sharon.
I'm willing to support the amendment.
Senator Rest.
I would also ask if there's any comment by election officials who are present.
Good point, Senator Rest. Are there comments, concerns by election officials? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to comment on this change? I see Mr. Tom Ferber from the City of Bloomington. Please state your name for the record. Welcome, Mr. Ferber.
Thank you, Chair Larson. My name is Tom Ferber. I'm the city clerk at the City of Bloomington. I also serve on the Minnesota Clerks and Finance Officers Association and the League of Minnesota Cities Elections Committee. I'm testifying in favor of this. Beth Fraser from the Secretary of State's office, who had to leave, indicated that the Secretary's office is in support of this amendment. And I think one of the things that it is trying to accomplish is that the witness requirement for the registered voters, very often that can be if the voter doesn't get that witness signature on there or forgets to have it on there, then when the absentee ballot is processed by the election judges, it has to be rejected because that has not been completed. So that's one of the things that a voter has went through all of the process of applying for an absentee ballot, voting their ballot, sending it back into the precinct or the city, and then we're in a situation where that voter has done everything they can except for get that witness, and then that vote isn't counted. So I think this is would address that issue, and so we're in support of this bill amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Ferber. Are there any questions for Mr. Ferber? Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Watson.
A technical note, I think in light of the amendment just adopted, we should consider an additional change to the bill on line 1.25, where that language, if the voter was not previously registered, where that came from. Since that requirement has been moved to the beginning of the sentence, I think it can be stricken from that clause, because the whole clause, the whole sentence then is subject to the voter having not been previously registered.
All right.
Okay.
So it's striking.
So, Mr. Chairman, on page 1, line 25 of the amendment, strike if the voter was not previously registered, comma.
Okay. And Senator Marty, incorporation in the A5 amendment. Is there further discussion? Senator Marty moves that Senate file number 208 be amended with the A5 amendment. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Gerlach, to the bill.
Bill, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Were there any other testifiers, or maybe I should ask that first?
Good point, Senator Gerlach. Are there others that would like to testify on the bill, either in favor of or in opposition to the bill? I don't see anybody coming forward. Senator Gerlach.
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, thank you, and Senator Sharon. I am struggling with the bill here because I think that half of it I really like, and the other half I think is problematic. And we haven't spent a lot of time on the broader absentee ballots, you know, kind of opening up to everybody. So let me just start with this, and then I want to suggest an amendment that I would like you to consider. The two halves of the bill, one is the things we've been adding here that you're bringing forth, the ability for disabled people to have easier access to voting. I think that those are all wonderful things, and I think that that's great. And we allow, in our elections law, we allow all sorts of special exceptions for people to make sure that we aren't disenfranchising those who need that additional help so we can get everybody on the level playing field. And I applaud that, and I think that's good. And I think that those elements of the bill, I think, will have broad support and both in both bodies, and I would expect the governor would too. I don't see any problem there. I think that's good. However, the other portion, sections 1 and 2, where we're just opening up the absentee ballots, you probably know that that's not without controversy. Over the years, we've had a lot of discussion about this in the legislature, and we seem to have there's sort of two ways, as I see, that how we sort of expand the voting. One is a method, multiple methods on election day, or, you know, where we talked about people in the past about faxing in ballots or other methods of mailing in, or methods, we talk about internet voting, and is that the future? And we talk about all those things, and they're interesting, they're not without their pitfalls. We talk about integrity and making sure we maintain the system and we don't have fraud in the system, and those are all good and worthy debates. The other dimension is expanding the time, and that's what we're looking at here, is we're opening up the time frame by which the general population who doesn't need the extra special leveling of the playing field, so to speak, can just vote out of convenience. And I think that there's some controversy there, and the reason I think a lot of it is the nature of our elections these days. We have elections that with a 24-hour news cycle and with the internet and so many things, that things happen so quick. And we're seeing more often, too, I think, where developments happen in a campaign where suddenly a whole lot of people have already voted. Sometimes it's happens intentionally. Someone may drop out. We had obviously a good example is the unfortunate plane crash of a few years ago with Senator Wellstone, and that changed dramatically. I think elections officials here know that there was some hoops to jump through to try to figure out how to deal with that. I don't even know how that was all dealt with. Those people who had already voted. If we open this up, I think that this merging we're getting a merging of the campaign season with our election. It's supposed to be campaigning, and then we take the poll that counts, as we like to say, the only poll that counts is on election day. That's the culmination of everybody's activity, and all that is to be said is said by then. and that's it. When we open up the broad-based absentee ballot or people just kind of going up to the window and voting early for an extended period of time, we can end up with dramatic changes in an election that can happen days, you know, or you know, days before that so many people have cast their ballots already. And I think that I'm not settled on that is a good way to go, that merging the campaigns that are still going on hot and heavy. We know that the bulk of the campaign activity happens when? In the last, 2 weeks of a campaign? When do we drop our direct mail? When does the bulk of the direct mail hit? When do those commercials really hit? When does all that really happen? And it happens at the very end, and we're going to have that happening on top of a general population that is just casting their ballots out of convenience and such. And I'm just not comfortable with that. And I think that with your bill, I think that the earlier part here that I talked about, I think is going to have broad support, is going to sail through, and it's a good thing. I think opening up the absentee ballots that wide, I think you're going to run into a lot of difficulty. I can't vote for the bill as it is with that in there like that. And I think you'll find others of that. And maybe it's a minority and maybe it won't matter. You'll have to make that calculation. But I think that if it didn't have the wide open absentee ballots and if it stuck to the other elements, I think that the bill passes very easily and such. So I want to suggest, based on those grounds, I think that let's pass the parts here for the frail and elderly. We're not calling it that anymore, but those who need those extra provisions in the law. But let's not open up to the general populace. I'm going to suggest, Mr. Chair, an amendment to, I believe it would be deleting sections 1 and 2. If that's still, based on the other amendments we've done, that will maintain the elements that we're here with the agents and helping the disabled. It'll maintain the Marty amendments. And those things I think will pass, and I think we can take the other part out. And so, Senator Sharon, I'm making that motion for that amendment to strike sections 1 and 2, and I'm hopeful that you would support that.
Senator Gerlach moves to strike sections 1 and 2 from the bill. Senator Rest.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would oppose the amendment, and I think the voting absentee without having to have an excuse, and I really mean that, an excuse, not a reason, but an excuse, is the heart of the bill. And the I don't think that you actually would, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think you'd actually find a flood of people who would all of a sudden be voting absentee because they didn't have to check an excuse. It's just that those who really need to vote absentee but can't fit into the excuse that is there on the application don't have to lie about it. And they are—they don't have to feel uncomfortable about it when they know that they want to vote absentee, and they're going to do it, and they do it now. And we're just taking that burden of dissembling off of the application. I don't know that we would have a flood of people voting ahead of the election. I agree with your comments about the. A lot of activity goes in those final days, but I think also that people that would be voting absentee would be voting absentee, and I think we're just making the system more honest rather than encouraging a flood of people that for quote mere convenience would see a huge increase in absentee ballots.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Gerlach, I want to give a couple reasons why I think your amendment isn't the best choice, one of which is your point about not blurring the line between you're saying the campaign and then election. seems to me a lot of those last-minute flyers, a lot of those last-minute mailings tend to be last-minute smear stuff. If you have know that 20% of the voters are voting early, maybe they'll do their smear early enough that people can respond to it. Or they'll miss a lot of those people in getting their smear. So I frankly think that's not the best argument for that. The other thing, however, though, is that a lot of people right now vote for convenience. They vote absentee. And they check one of those little boxes on the thing because you technically have to. And the people who tend not to do that tend to be some of the senior citizen types who are very fastidious about it, abiding by every the law. The letter of the law is precise as they can, and it says you're unable to go to the polls because of illness, disability, for a religious holiday reason, or you're out of town. And they're not really out of town. They're not unable to go to the polls, and they're scared to do it, so they don't vote for convenience, even though they know it might snow on election day, they might have trouble getting out, so they don't choose to do so. However, a lot of people do that, and I was going to, just a flyer here from Bill Cooper, Republican Party Chair of Minnesota from 1998, and I have plenty of them from, this one's from 2002, I believe. The flyers, here's one. Dear concerned voter, the Republican primary election September 15th, general election November 3rd, for many getting to the polls can be difficult due to work, which is not a legitimate excuse, being out of town, or other challenges. He was sending this out, blast mailing it to Republican voters, I presume, which I think he ought to be able to do, but we ought to have the law comply with what he's doing, namely saying that if you want to vote for convenience, absentee, vote by convenience. I think it's a great idea what he does. It's just I don't think that complies with the law the way it is. And you know, somebody, it has the application for absentee ballot on the form, which they send back to Republican Party headquarters, and then they can, if they forgot to check a box, I'm sure they check absent from precinct or whatever and send it in. The point is, a lot of people may fudge the law that way. And I'm saying, why should we have those who are trying to comply with every precise detail of the law and saying, you know, I'm not out of town and I'm not unable to go because of illness or disability. It's going to be more convenient for me. Again, I don't think what your party does is a bad idea. I just think we ought to make sure the law says that everybody should be able to do that.
Let's hear from Senator Sharon, the author of the bill, and I'm sure that Senator Gerlach will want to respond. I'd remind committee members we're coming upon our time for the committee to conclude, and so let's keep that in mind. Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Chair Larson and Senator Gerlach. I appreciate what you're saying, and I think you are talking about the heart of the issue in terms of where people will struggle with their support for this. Obviously, in those arguments that you presented against the arguments that are presented on the other side, I've been persuaded that it is in the best interest of the voters to move towards this model. So I'm saying that only recognizing that what you're talking about is also in the situation that there is information that is presented and the deadline is established if the voting date is on a particular voting day. But I've been persuaded, and that's why I am presenting it in this language, that many voters are already voting by absentee without the legitimate reason they're checking the box, and that I also think that people are capable of saying, do I want to early vote, knowing that there may be information that's presented and that my deadline for voting now is the election day. And I think the majority of voters will continue to want to stay in the pipeline as long as they possibly can, gathering information. But this allows for those who may choose to do otherwise.
Senator Gerlach.
So I'll just conclude with speaking in favor of my amendment. And I would urge you to consider, I almost wish
these were two separate bills, because then it's easy. But they're not. They're together. So I would... I guess I urge you to vote for my amendment.
Senator Pappas, did you have a question? Senator Gerlach renews his motion, his verbal amendment that would strike Section 1 and 2 from the bill. Any further discussion? All those in favor of the amendment indicate by saying aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
No.
The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Senator Rest.
I would move that Senate File 208 as amended be recommended to pass.
Senator Rest moves that Senate File 208 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the full committee on state and local government operations and oversight. Is there further discussion? All those in favor of the motion indicate by saying aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Good discussion.
This committee is adjourned. Thank you, everyone.